Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams. Are all New Mexico students getting the same quality of education? A lawsuit against the state says the answer is no, and that low-income kids, kids who speak languages other than English, and kids with disabilities aren't getting their fair share. Lawyers for Governor Susana Martinez say the state's doing its best, but if the judge agrees, this case could reshape the way New Mexico funds its public schools. This week on Let's Talk New Mexico, we're diving into the challenges faced by our state's most vulnerable students. How can the state provide equal education to all? Would spending more money solve the problem, or do we need to change how we spend money on education altogether? Are you a teacher, a student, or the parent of a student affected by poor funding and few resources and opportunities in your school district? Do you think New Mexico has just resigned itself to being at the bottom of all the lists about education? We want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open at 277-KUNM. That's 505-277-5866. Or send your thoughts by email to letstalk@kunm.org. Joining us in the KUNM studios to talk about equal access to education are Suzanne Nguyen, who directs federal bilingual, low-income, and Native American programs at Rio Rancho Public Schools, and Edward Tabat-Cubero, executive director of the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty. We also have Trish Mokino on the phone with us today. She is education director at Karis Learning Center in Cochiti Pueblo. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
All right. Well, most people know that New Mexico is at the bottom of the list when it comes to educational achievement. And that's especially true for students of color and students from low-income families. Now, Edward, you say that this isn't an achievement gap we're talking about. It's an opportunity gap. What do you mean by that?
Ray, good morning. Thank you. I think that the whole term achievement gap and combined with the narrative that we've seen coming out of the administration would try to place the blame on the students themselves, that somehow New Mexico students have some kind of shortcomings and that's why we rank 50th. And we think that's simply not true, that our students are just as capable, are just as intelligent, have just as much potential as any students around the country. And so 50th is inexcusable in our minds. And we think that it's fundamentally a matter of providing our students the right types of supports and resources that they need to succeed.
And your argument here is that this is actually unconstitutional because New Mexico guarantees equal and sufficient education to all its students, regardless of background?
Right. Yeah. The framers of our New Mexico Constitution in 1912 wrote that the state's obligated to provide a uniform system of free public schools sufficient for the education of all children of school age. And if you just look at the academic outcomes that you referred to in the opening, the fact that we, as New Mexico, are last in the opportunity for success category, you know, that we provide for our students, you can see that what's being provided is grossly insufficient, particularly for all students, but particularly for low-income English language learner and Native American students.
You said last in opportunity. What was that category you said?
Yeah, there's a measurement called opportunity for success. And it's a composite of academic outcomes, poverty rates, joblessness rates. You know, it's this composite score. And New Mexico consistently ranks 50th in the opportunity we give our children to succeed.
In other words, the school systems in a lot of ways are not preparing kids for employment, for life after high school.
That indicator is not just the school systems, but all of the other factors related to poverty, joblessness, and so on.
Right, right. And I think it is probably important to not confine this just to schools, right? I mean, this is an issue that has to do with families, with unemployment outside of school. Suzanne, you're working with a lot of the kinds of students that we're talking about right now. What does this look like in Rio Rancho in the schools that you're working in?
So I would like to just jump along with what Edward was saying, in that this is truly an opportunity. We do see good student achievement results in our school district, and we see that all around the state. You just need to look at the data. And I really like what you said, Ed, in that this is an issue that needs to be addressed at a much wider audience, not just within the school system. We look at all of our stakeholders, parents, community members. It's the responsibility of ourselves, our instructional staff, our students. And the challenges that we see are the insufficient resources to be able to do what we need to do. We, just like Susana Martinez says, you know, they do their best and we do our absolute best. And it's our moral imperative to offer this to all of our students through our rich programming, but there's only so much we can do with our limited resources.
And help me understand, though. I mean, there is money going to schools, but you know, you're saying, a lot of people are saying, it's not enough money. Why are these groups of students, the students from low-income families, Native American students, students who maybe are learning English, why are they disproportionately affected by the way that schools are funded?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you look at the outcomes and you can see that, you know, 73% or 76% of white students in our state graduate from high school, and only 63% of Native American students, who are just as intelligent and just as capable. The issue is that we're not providing the types of programming that most effectively serve these students. And we have decades upon decades of research. I don't think there's any disagreement about the types of programmings that work. And I think the key issue is we're only offering these programs to some students and not others. So universal access to pre-K, we're offering that to some students but not others. That perpetuates achievement gaps. Access to bilingual and multicultural education programs are offered to some but not others. We know that dual language program, for example, which is open to all students, that's the beauty of it, that English speakers and speakers of other languages come together in one classroom to learn multiple languages. Those are the only programs that have been proven to close the achievement gap for English language learners. And yet, out of over 900 schools in our state, only 115 offer dual language programming. So what we're saying is, you know, kind of with that uniformity clause in the Constitution, that these types of programs should be offered to all. I think in addition to that, there's some great work being done in communities and schools. You can see, you know, communities and schools in Santa Fe offering a wonderful set of 360-degree wraparound social work-type supports to students in 11 schools. But there's over 24 schools there with children that aren't getting those types of services.
So it's kind of like a one-size-fits-all approach that the state has to education, and that one size just doesn't fit certain groups. Am I understanding that correctly?
Correct. And I think what we've done is provided kind of a patchwork of programs that we know work to some children but not to all, and that's highly problematic. And that does come down to funding. You know, I've worked in public education for 20 years now, and I've never met a single parent that didn't value education and didn't want the absolute best for their children. So we have motivated families, we have talented and caring teachers, we have, you know, students with all the potential in the world, and it's a matter of what is the state providing, you know, our system in order for our students to do better than 50th.
Well, Tricia Mokino, you are working at CARES Learning Center, which is out in Kochiti, and you're working with Native American children and on language issues, right? Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing and what this kind of one-size-fits-all approach we're talking about means for kids coming from tribal communities?
Right. So at CARES Children's Learning Center, we have grown into two classrooms now, and we serve students from Kochiti Pueblo, with the primary vehicle of instruction being in our language of CARES. And in order to start the CARES Children's Learning Center, we had to first get tribal council approval and the partnership. So we work in partnership with the Pueblo of Kochiti, the leadership. And in our primary classroom, which is 3 to 6 years old, it's an immersion classroom, and we use the Montessori method as one of the drivers for the curriculum that we use. But the medium of instruction is all in CARES. And then we opened the elementary one classroom, which is a multi-age classroom, 6 to 9 years old. And that is a dual language education program. In dual language, there are several different models, and ours would be considered a one-way heritage language program. And in that classroom, we have three of our students who have been with us since the school opened 5 years ago. So they're actually going into their sixth year of being at CARES Children's Learning Center, and they are bilingual now. They're bilingual, meaning they can speak in CARES, they can speak in English. You know, they're always going to be working towards their fluency, but they can carry a conversation in CARES. They can also read. They can write in cursive. They are doing complex math problems. They are starting research in their areas of interest, we just started school, so we already have children who are doing research on the oceans, that are doing research on the mammals. Some just wrote a map of our village of the important buildings in our village. So there's all sorts of stuff going on just alone in the little dual language elementary one classroom.
But don't you have children yourself that are in public schools?
I do. And my girls, my oldest is in eighth grade and the youngest is in fifth grade. And they were the inspiration for me wanting to start CARES Children's Learning Center because my oldest daughter was fluent in our CARES language. And at the time we were in Cochiti, and she was as fluent as a three-year-old could be in any language. And when it was time for her to go to early childhood setting, there was not one that would provide continued learning in our CARES language. Because at that time, there's early childhood settings that were in English. So that she was the inspiration for wanting to start KCLC. So I have an obligation to continue to support my girls, which they are in a public school. At Santo Domingo Elementary School, which is a part of Bernalillo Public Schools. And my daughter just brought home a letter on Monday saying that the middle school got an F, you know, whatever that means. I would like to talk about that more, but I don't know if you have questions out of what I just said.
No, definitely. Well, I want to go to a caller who is calling along the same lines. It's Lana. I hope I'm saying your name right, Lana. Is it Lana or Lana?
It's Lana.
Lana, hi, Lana. So you're with Walatoa Head Start Program?
Yes, I am. I'm the Early Childhood Program Manager here.
What's your take on what Tricia was talking about? I mean, are you seeing this need for kids coming from tribal communities, you know, to preserve their culture, to preserve their language? Is that a challenge in the public school district? How are you dealing with that?
Oh, definitely. Tricia and I are colleagues. We work together, and we have the same passion and belief for our children in each of our pueblos. And for us here at Head Start, we're also, since we are a Head Start program, we are preparing our children for kindergarten, for academic success, but we're doing it in a way that identifies and who they are and where they come from. And we do that through using a Head Start curriculum, but supplementing it with our traditional calendar, which is the different events that happen in our community throughout the year, as well as a theme calendar based around our language and culture, which came out of a photo voice project that the parents conducted back in 2008.
You know, I wonder if, and Tricia, you can answer this too, but do kids that learn in their native language like this, does it help them, you know, work in science and math or other subjects if they're able to do that on their own? I mean, in their own language other than English? Is there a difference that you see in academic performance when the kids are actually able to be bilingual in their cultural heritage language?
Well, it certainly enhances it. It enhances their learning. It enhances their academic understanding of what they're studying because they have two worldviews to pull from. They have the worldview, and if they have the blessed opportunity to continue to learn in their own, like our own native language of Karis, they are going to only get stronger in understanding our worldview. And then, of course, there's the English worldview. And so a benefit of learning in two languages, and that I see not only with the children that I work with at KCLC, but with my own girls, that they have a different way of approaching different subjects. They have I don't want to just say it's two different ways, but, you know, they just have an enhanced ability to understand something or a concept more fully.
You know, I think we have 40 years of research on that exact topic. There's been 7 independent meta-analyses conducted that have all come to the same conclusion, that children who are learning in multiple languages in a bilingual setting actually end up not just closing the achievement gap, but outperforming monolingual students. We also have, you know, decades now of brain research that shows that folks that are bilingual have increased cognitive flexibility, which is, you know, what Trish is referring to. Bilingualism actually offsets the onset of Alzheimer's. There's all kinds of cognitive benefits from it. And I think there's a fundamental question in our state around whether we want to view multilingualism with a deficit lens or an asset lens. And I think, you know, in tribal communities, there's very distinct needs of these sovereign nations who are trying to maintain not just kind of this feel good, you know, culture and language piece, but to maintain their governance systems, to maintain their faith life. You know, they have to have the language, which has been stripped for generations from these communities. On the other end of things here in New Mexico, where, you know, 60% of our students are Hispanic, you know, in the amongst the Spanish speaking community, you know, the business folks in our state understand that as a tremendous asset, that bilingualism actually gives our state a leg up in a global economy. And so I think this is a precious natural resource that our state possesses that we're losing over time. And I think we need to be investing in that.
We're talking about the challenges facing New Mexico students of color, students with disabilities, students from families with low incomes, and ways that we could overcome those challenges. Trisha Mokino from Karis Learning Center is on the phone with us. Edward Tabat Cubero from New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty and Suzanne Nguyen from Rio Rancho Public Schools are here in the studio. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from New Mexico Wine, presenting the Harvest Wine Festival this weekend, Saturday through Monday, at Balloon Fiesta Park. Wine tastings from 20 wineries, 15 bands on two stages, food and art. Info at nmwine.com.
Every orchestra is part of a community, of course. So how does an orchestra respond when a natural disaster affects everyone and everything? I'm Fred Child. Join me for updates from the Houston Symphony in the wake of Hurricane Harvey on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico, and we're back talking about access to education for New Mexico students. Do you or your kids speak English as a second language? What has your experience in the public school system been? What would have made it better? Or are you a bilingual education teacher, and have you seen programs that help your students succeed? Give us a call now. The number is 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or email letstalk@KUNM.org. And let's go to the phones right now. Leslie is on the line with us from Albuquerque. Leslie, are you there?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
You have children in dual language programs.
Actually, I do. I have two children that participated here in Albuquerque in a charter school dual language program. And I wanted to call in and give just a parent perspective. First, I want to thank you for having this important conversation, because I don't think we have these conversations enough. And secondly, as a native New Mexican, there is a piece of our culture and our heritage that I think has been lost in many families because of public education, because our grandparents went to school and were, you know, punished for speaking Spanish as a second language or another language. And so I think it's very important that we talk about these things and talk about the successes of dual language programs, which is why I called. So I have two children that attended public school and were in this dual language program. And I personally, as a parent, could see exactly what everyone on this panel has been talking about, the research, you know, how their thinking is different than my older daughter, who wasn't able to attend school in a dual language setting. And as young adults now, my middle child, who is in 11th grade, when he was in the third grade in this dual language program, I saw him struggle, which was very challenging for me as a parent because he was learning to speak a language that I couldn't actually help him with in school because I'm not bilingual. And so as he continued, you know, along in the grades, I saw this change in him that was absolutely amazing. And by the eighth grade, my son was reading at a senior level in high school. And I absolutely believe, and I know in my heart that it's because he's bilingual and biliterate, and he had this ability to do things that I couldn't do at his age. And I don't know if that makes any sense, but,
well, I wonder,
but I really, go ahead.
You know, Edward was just talking about how these kinds of language skills are a real business asset. Maybe your son is not thinking about work yet after public schools, but is he thinking about going into a job maybe where he could use the language skills that he's learning in high school?
I will tell you that both of my kids are already kind of setting their sights on positions where they know that their language is going to be an asset. Being able to be bilingual is going to help them. And I come from a business background, and I will tell you from my own personal experience, I've seen exactly what the business leaders in our community are talking about when they're looking for this bilingual workforce and the challenges that they face in trying to fill positions. And I mean, for me, yes, I saw the benefits from the very beginning of my kids being in these programs because of the business side of my outlook. But it really, what brought it home for me was bringing back that piece of language and culture and heritage into my family that we have lost, like so many other New Mexicans in our community.
Thanks for that, Leslie. Let's go to another call from Juliosa in Santa Fe.
Yes, hello. My name is Julia Rosa, and I am a member of the Coalition for the Majority, a group of very concerned citizens and supporters of bilingual education. And I was listening at your previous speaker, and one of the things that we did were we proposed a bill, and actually the governor signed it 2 years ago, to provide all high school students in New Mexico an opportunity to have a seal on their diploma declaring that they're bilingual and bicultural. So they have to meet the requirements of both languages, Spanish and English. And once they graduate and they meet the requirements, then they're able to show that on their diploma. And it is an asset because business people are looking for bilingual employees. And also we are encouraging these students that have the bilingual seal to go on to the university and become bilingual teachers. So those are to provide opportunities for students to close that gap in programming and letting everyone know that they're actually. But in order to be able to do that, you have to have K through 12 bilingual programs, and not all schools have those.
Well, you know, I'll take this to both of you. The Hispanic Education Act and the Indian Education Act say, if I'm understanding correctly, that bilingual education is mandated for bilingual and ESL students, right?
Yeah,
is that not working in New Mexico? I mean, we seem to already have laws on the books supporting this kind of education.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I appreciate the advocacy of folks like Dr. Emsley, who just called in, who's been engaged in this work for 40 years, you know, trying to support things like the Hispanic Education Act, Indian Education Act. We have the country's first funded bilingual education act from the early 70s. And, excuse me, in our state constitution, the Constitution actually calls for the preparation of a bilingual teaching force. So we have the most progressive policy in the country. It's a matter of political will to actually implement it and fund it. And if you look back to 1912, when our state constitution mandated the preparation of a bilingual teaching force, about two-thirds of our families spoke a language other than English in the home. And most of them, like my great-grandparents, you know, at the time also spoke English. They were bilingual. Let's not get this wrong. We want folks to also, all of our kids need to learn English as well. But right now, we've gone from two-thirds to about one-third of our families that speak another a language other than English at home. And we're seeing that as a tremendous lost resource in our state. It's something that we're giving away. So along with funding revenue sources that the you know, state government has given away, we've also given away our language, unfortunately. And it's something that I think, you know, your callers are saying that we actually need to take back, bring back into our schools, because we know the benefits academically and professionally for our children.
You know, historically, though, there's been kind of a pushback for a lot of families and students who don't speak English. There's been kind of an assimilation, and you should speak English and not your native language. That's the way to succeed. Mm-hmm. Is that something that that you're having to deal with now? There's been almost a stigma in the past, right, about speaking languages other than English.
Yeah, and let me say, first and foremost, we should speak English. Like, that is important, yes. And the question is, do you have to give up the language that was gifted to you by your parents and your grandparents in that process? And we would say no. The second thing we would say is, again, there's 40 years of research that shows that actually teaching students in multiple languages so that they can learn content in a language they understand, that they develop this positive sense of identity, actually helps to close the achievement gap. And we're seeing across the country a move towards the expansion of bilingual and dual language programming. And so we have this resource here in New Mexico, but states like Utah and North Carolina are actually outpacing us in the expansion of these programs, which seems kind of ludicrous to me.
Tricia, you were going to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something. I think, you know, in the case of, you know, of course, with education, there is the part about the closing the achievement gap, and then business and creating bilingual people. But we have to go back to the soul of New Mexico, and the soul of New Mexico, it has, you know, first started with indigenous communities, and then we have the beauty of the Hispanic communities and their language and their cultures. And we have to strengthen with regard to our tribes, strengthen first the language for the purpose of for our people first. Because when you have healthy families, you're going to have healthier children, and you have healthier children going to school. And we also have to do truth and reconciliation and healing in this state. Brian Stevenson talks about that. And I think that process needs to start, because until you do that, you have so much internalized racism in our communities, internalized this distorted ideas of what education looks like. And for indigenous communities all over the United States, including in New Mexico, we have been, it has been drilled to us that our languages are not enough, that we're not enough, that our children are not smart enough. And that is just not true. And, you know, we have to flip that switch. So while at CARES Children's Learning Center, yes, we are, our children are learning in our language, we have to be very intentional about how we work with parents and families, and be inclusive genuinely of our elders, of our parents, of all the generations, because we have to do healing also in the way of healing ourselves and healing our ideas about rethinking and redefining what Indian education is for our people. If we have any chance of survival of our languages, and then furthermore, our culture.
Well, parents, have you run into this kind of situation with your kids in school? Have you run into cultural barriers when reaching out to your kids' school with problems or questions? We want to hear from you, so give us a call at 277-5866. That's 277-5866. And let's go back to the phones. Roger is calling from Jemez. Hi, Roger. Thanks for your call.
Hey, Ed. Good morning. Very proud to participate in this very exciting call you have. I'm the parent of four college students from the Pueblo of Jemez. I'm also the executive director of Flower Hill Institute, and Flower Hill Institute is working with tribal communities, with STEM, South Central Science Center, University of Oklahoma, New Mexico State University, and other University of Arizona, and others, to bring in STEM knowledge alongside indigenous knowledge through traditional leaders in their own native languages. So we have kids in the rivers and walking the landscapes and touching the ground and touching plants and talking about important things like weather and climate change and things like that in their own indigenous languages from an indigenous perspective and not just a science perspective. So that's the kind of work that we're trying to do to try and help fill in some of the gaps. So I think it really is all hands on deck with whole communities, with parents first, community organizations such as ours, tribal organizations, public schools and institutions. I mean, if you think back about the genesis of education in these United States with, you know, the Cherokee adding to the alphabet and governance from the Mohawk tribes up in New England. And then you look at the genius of Chaco Canyon and energy and engineering and architecture and things like that. I mean, there's a lot to be proud of in terms of indigenous knowledge through indigenous languages. And tribes are the fastest growing. Indian people are the fastest growing of the U.S. population by race. We're growing about 4% per year, doubling our tribal populations. And we have our heroes. I mean, you've got folks like Brophy Toledo at the Pueblo Jemez writing his own curriculum through his own stories. And then spreading that throughout our community. You've got Santa Fe Indian School, and what a great model that institution has been. SIPI, and they're winning the
Robot Swarmathon.
And beating Division I schools. Right. I mean, it's amazing what's going on in Indian education. But if you think back to New Mexico ranking 50 at their last, we're surrounded by Colorado and their great economy, and Arizona and their great economy, and Texas. So I think really it's our political decision-making that has inhibited and sometimes even prohibited a development, especially in areas like education.
Right.
And I think that we need to, as a state, kind of wake up and look at our whole communities and get all hands on deck and get lots of people involved.
Well, thanks for that perspective, Roger. Let's go right away to Carmen, calling from Rio Rancho.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Carmen.
I run a college access organization that services Native American students from across the nation, and there are two things that I want to say about bilingual programs. Part of the college application process for many of our colleges require a foreign language mastery. So even for our students to apply to some colleges, they have to be able to have a second language. So this is why it's also important for Indigenous students or for our Hispanic students in the state of New Mexico to have that opportunity from K through 12 to have that mastery of their home language, because it can be used towards college. And in fact, in college, when they are there, there's another level of language requirement. And many of our colleges, including Harvard and Stanford and Dartmouth and Duke, they allow Indigenous students to petition to have that home language be get credit for it in college. So it's ironic if we're not helping students in K through 12 to have that mastery of their language and then turn around in college and all of a sudden value it. This is also true by college admission officers. They're interested in the worldviews, as Tricia had said, of the home communities. And language is what helps us to see the world in a different way and to solve problems in a different way. And the last point that I would make, too, when I think about it being a Navajo person, you know, we have the history of the Navajo code talkers from World War II. So, again, we have this time in our history where we value Indigenous language for a time and hold it up. It helps us to win this incredible war. And yet when those servicemen come back home and have their families in their public schools, then this language is not being valued anymore. And we can't do that to honor a language at one moment in our military history and then put it to the side and not fund it the way that it should be with the teachers in K through 12. So that's what I have to say. There's a tie to higher education with bilingual opportunities for our students in New Mexico.
Well, thanks for that, Carmen. And Suzanne, I wonder if, in your experience at Rio Rancho Public Schools, what this has been like, because I think for most people in most of the country, when we think of dual language, we think of Spanish and English. Right. In our public schools here, are we giving equal attention to native languages, or are we favoring Spanish or another kind of Western language over Indigenous languages when we talk about dual education?
So starting this school year, actually, our classes started this week I'm sorry, last school year we started Navajo Language 1, but I do want to bring up the point that there are so many different languages and cultures, and really it's about identity that's represented in all of our communities. So, of course, within New Mexico, we have the rich asset of having the Spanish heritage and indigenous cultures, but in our city of Rio Rancho, we serve students that come from all of our New Mexico recognized tribes, federally recognized tribes. Actually, last school year, we graduated 11 students who attained the state seal of bilingualism and biliteracy, which we're very proud of them for their accomplishments. And those were in the languages of Italian, French, German, as well as Spanish. So we have so much diversity, again, not just in Rio Rancho, but in our whole world, in all pockets of all communities. So that's part of the challenge, too. We've got linguistic diversity, we've got cultural diversity, students coming from all different entry points, and we do everything we can to provide the most rich education for all of our students.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're broadcasting live from the University of New Mexico, and we're talking about whether students of color, students with disabilities, and students from low-income families are getting the education they need from public schools and ways to address all New Mexico students' needs. What do you think our state, or do you think our state is doing enough to address the needs of all students? And what resources would help our schools achieve more? Are you in a part of the state that's struggling with resources and teachers and schools? Give us a call now. The number to call is 877-899-5866, 877-899-5866, or you can join the conversation on Twitter, where we're live tweeting the program using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back in a minute.
Cars can stand for a whole lot more than just a way to get somewhere. They're our first taste of independence. They carry lots of memories. Even after we can't drive anymore, we may hold on to them as a way of, well, holding on. So when you decide to donate your car to KUNM, we know what a special gift you're giving. We are truly honored that you chose us. To donate your car, call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Native fashion designers are putting their talent on the runway more and more with designs that include floral pattern bodycons and geometric pattern corset dresses. Many invoke traditional designs. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with a few designers about what inspires them. We hope you'll make plans to join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth investigative coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. In a state as diverse as New Mexico, how can we guarantee students of all backgrounds get the education they need? If you're a student or the parent of a student, what challenges have you come up against in school? Do you find the schools willing to hear you out about your concerns? Give us a ring, 877-899-5866. You can also post comments to our Facebook page. Edward and Suzanne, a lot of this comes down to funding. I mean, basically the foundation of the lawsuit that the Center on Law and Poverty has filed is saying that we're not funding these programs enough, right? Is this really a problem we can spend our way out of? I mean, we're already giving, what, 44% of our state's budget to education? I mean, would more money really do what we think it would in this case, or what you think it would?
Yeah, I think that the first point on that is it's not a matter of spinning our way out. I think the first point is you just had a series of callers from Native American and Hispanic communities who are highly motivated to ensure the best education possible for their children. And so the voices of the families who are most impacted by our state's education system need to be elevated. They need to be given access to the system. And I think that oftentimes the state and public education department have set them off to the side, which is unfortunate. The other piece is, I think, going back to your original point when you opened around this idea of opportunity gaps. And so, you know, the programs that were just mentioned by Tricia and Lena and Carmen and Roger are too far and few and far in between. So what we end up having is this patchwork of programming that's offered to some children, but not to others. And what we're saying is, if we know it works, and nobody's going to argue or dispute the research that says, you know, universal access to pre-K, providing 360-degree wraparound services, bilingual and dual language education programming, that those kinds of programs close the achievement gap for our historically underserved students. Nobody's going to argue with those. And is there a price tag on them? Yes, there is. And the unfortunate reality is that over the past about 10 to 15 years, our state has simply given away our revenues. So we've given them away in 2003 with a major tax reduction for New Mexico's highest earners. We gave them away between 2013 and heading into 2018 with Governor Martinez's corporate income tax reduction. So we've given away hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then we turn around and try to balance the budget on the backs of our school children, and we think that's really the issue.
Well, I should say that we did invite the Public Education Department to be on the program and give their perspective. They said that they couldn't comment because there's a lawsuit pending. We also reached out to the governor's office, and they just ignored our calls. So unfortunately, we don't have that perspective in here. But I do want to reach out to Trish really quickly before I know you have to go, Trish. But you know, you created a program that is basically encompassing a lot of the elements that we've been talking about: dual language education, cultural education. Was that more expensive for you to do? I mean, was that like a really financially difficult thing at Caris Learning Center? Trisha might not be there anymore. Well, I'll put that to you.
Can you hear me, Ed?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, can you hear? Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, it was very difficult, but we finally got the partnership, and we're grateful to all our funders. We did get the ANA Administration for Native Americans, Esther Martinez Language Immersion Grant, but it's still a struggle. And I think the ultimate goal is to continue to advocate and work with policymakers and legislators and the federal government, because ultimately our children that are at KCLC are still entitled. They have funds attached, you know, to them as children, and they have a right to that funding. And our hope eventually is to someday be able to access state funding to support schools like Caris Children's Learning Center.
Hmm. Well, thanks a lot, Trisha. I appreciate your perspective there. Let's turn back to the phones now. We have some calls lining up with Phoebe from Cochise de Pueblo. Hi, Phoebe.
Hey.
Thanks for your
call.
Good
morning. Can you hear me?
I can. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi. My name's Phoebe, and my kids go up to Caris Children's Learning Center. Oh. And my oldest daughter, Kuamot, has been there from the very beginning. So I just kind of wanted to back up and also address some of the questions coming up today. And one of the things that I think the brilliancy of Trisha in starting Caris Children's Learning Center is the multi-component to the resource questions that have been asked earlier. So she's been able to bring tribal council support, leadership support. We've been able to get some grants, but the parent and the family component is so essential to making a successful program, especially educational program for our children. And I know many times we've talked about taking back our education for our own children and really having the ability to be sovereign entities in terms of Pueblo communities, of taking back our education and educating our children in how we see life and our way of life, and where the language component in Caris is such an important part of that. And it's not just the education for just this time period of when they're in school, but it goes into lifelong learning education. So I had grandparents that when they were in their 90s, they were still learning through Caris and English as they grew up. So, but I just wanted to also reemphasize what we've been talking about just recently about the policy support and financial and funding. So, you know, I think with the Caris Children's Learning Center model, we've demonstrated some success. When I have a daughter who's 6 years old and she's doing multiplication in two different languages, talking one, two, three, four, and then the next words out of her mouth are ish, gimme, chomp, gana, and she's doing math problems in one problem in two different languages. That's one data point in demonstrating the excellence in the education and also the enhancement of what she's learning. But to talk about the policies and the support of what Tricia just mentioned is there's also that policy component where we have to advocate and change some of the policies, especially with programs that are succeeding and what our students are achieving. And so that's kind of what I wanted to just throw in into the mix and my support for dual language education and also support of all children throughout the state of New Mexico, because this, if we don't have a comprehensive education program from babies to even to through college, those are our next generation. And as we grow older, we're going to need those, the education and the strength of education of our youth to carry on. So thank you so much.
Thanks for that, Phoebe. And Phoebe mentioned, you know, young kids are needing this kind of education, but you know, pre-K can be crazy expensive, and there's only a certain number, right, of free slots in the state lottery. And what difference do you think it would make to start kids really early in this kind of education? And what support do you have for this from the state?
Yeah,
in
so
early childhood.
That's a great question. I think the CARES Children's Learning Center and Wauwatosa are two great examples, not only of linguistically and culturally responsive programming, but of pre-K and Head Start. And unfortunately, you know, we have 19,000 four-year-olds in New Mexico right now who need access to pre-K programming, and they don't have it because it's underfunded by the state, and the state continues to underfund that program. We had a Legislative Finance Committee report come out the week before last that said combining pre-K with our K-3 Plus program, that program that adds 25 extra school days in the summer, combining those two things completely closes the achievement gap for low-income children. Providing pre-K to Hispanic children closes 78% of the achievement gap right off the bat.
But
have 19,000 four-year-olds that don't have access to it.
But on the other hand, does providing pre-K as it is now to kids whose parents can afford it, does that widen the achievement gap?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. You know, I was assistant superintendent of Santa Fe Public Schools and oversaw the pre-K programming. And unfortunately, we had a list into the hundreds, a waiting list of parents who wanted into those programs, but because of limited state funding, could not get in. So then you're perpetuating a gap because you're offering that remedy to some children while others have to sit out because there's no room in the classroom for them because of a lack of state funding.
277-5866 is the number to call to join the conversation. We have an email from Jackie Rodriguez, who is the principal at Sandoval Academy of Bilingual Education. That's a dual language charter school in Rio Rancho. And she says it angers her that we face continued oppression and tactics to eliminate the mesh of beautiful cultures and languages. Lawmakers and policymakers are considering eliminating funding for these programs, and she hopes that the Center on Law and Poverty will be successful in demanding adequate funding. Let's go back to the phones with, we have a teacher on the line. Hi. Can you
Hi.
Hear me? How's it going? Sorry, I don't have your name here, but I see that you're a teacher.
Right, I am, and I only have a few minutes because I have to get back to something at school. It's
okay.
A school day. It's what I wanted to get out there is, last year when they were making cuts within APS, there was all that uproar about the states because parents complained. And then we heard some rumors of what they would cut next or what they were going to do. And we heard that they might be going after gifted. But a lot of people said, well, in the more affluent communities, those parents wouldn't put up with that. Well, it's what ended up happening, and we didn't know it till we came back to school now in the fall, is they left those schools untouched. I teach at a school where 100% of our children are free and reduced lunch, really high poverty in our community. And it's what has happened is they got rid of some of the positions at these schools. So the gifted teacher has to go to more than one school during the day. And it's what the problem is with that is that means that they can't grow the program at the school and work at identifying more children.
Mm. Well, I think it's, you know, just from the caller, what we know works for the children in her school are extended learning opportunities, extended school year opportunities, where they get more time in the classroom doing enrichment type activities like K-3+, the state funded program that's been highly successful. The legislature funded K-3+ this past year at the same rates that they have in the past, and yet the public education department made the decision to cut that program by 30%. And so districts like Albuquerque Public Schools actually had to deny access to that program to schools that had had it in the past. So we have 70,000 students in New Mexico who need K-3+, those extra 25 days that the state is denying access to.
Hmm. Suzanne, what's this look like in Rio Rancho? I mean, you're involved in these kinds of programs yourself. Are you given enough time and resources, or are the people you're working with given enough time and resources to actually implement these programs to help the, you know, students from these diverse backgrounds?
We rely so much on supplemental funding sources, where I think the conversation is really that it should be offered to all students. So that's a big piece of the problem. The supplemental funding sources are applied for annually through a grant process. So I want to bring the conversation back also to how it's shared and collective responsibility. Another challenge that we face in addition to the lack of resources is lack of teachers. So qualified, endorsed teachers to be able to work and serve within the programs that we offer. There's so many different pieces. Think about instructional materials, and let's talk about a Spanish bilingual program. We have materials in English, but the funding doesn't cover the materials in Spanish or the other language. So we have to find money to provide those resources. And then the teacher, like I talked about, and all those different pieces to be able to provide a really guaranteed viable curriculum in both languages for these students, whereas the students are all just viewed as one unit value. Our students aren't units. People are not units. We're really diverse. We come with many different needs, and we need additional resources to support and develop the assets that our students come in with.
You know, you said that this is a grant cycle you're dealing with. Does that mean there's uncertainty year to year on how much money you'll have, and is that playing out in terms of how you're able to carry out your programs?
Exactly. And depending on the funding source, it can either, for Title I, it's a school-wide program, which is the best model as far as supporting a program school-wide, making sure that what we provide is provided to all students in theory, and really bringing up the achievement of our low-income students. But with most of our other funding sources, it's targeted. Mm-hmm. So we rely on these targeted funding sources to only be able to spend it on certain kids for certain things, whereas it really needs to be available to all students. Not all students necessarily meet all criteria to fit that formula to be eligible for that funding source,
and
that's not equitable.
Well, we have just time for one more call that I want to get to before the show ends. So Melissa is on the line from Albuquerque. Hi, Melissa. Thanks for your call. We have not very much time, so quickly, please.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. So my name is Melissa Salazar, and I just recently retired with APS, 29 years, and 17 of those years I was the assistant principal at Valle Vista Elementary School. Valle Vista is a true dual language program. We are actually the pre-K hub for the Rio cluster. We're fortunate enough that we have 8 pre-K programs. Not all 8 programs, though, are state-funded programs. Only one of them is state-funded. The other ones are developmental pre-K programs, kids that have special needs. I also see the importance of early childhood education. And just real quickly, I can talk real highly about dual language programs. I just want to tell parents, because I saw it day in and day out, they get frustrated with the dual language programs because they see their kids struggling.
Right.
I have 2 kids.
But Melissa, we're going to have to cut you off. I'm so sorry, but I appreciate you calling in. We're out of time. If you missed part of this program or you want to hear it again, you can find it in past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Marino Spencer engineered the program today. Sarah Trujillo answered the phones. Elaine Baumgartel was live tweeting the show and is our executive producer. And Marisa DeMarco was our producer today. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and the McCune Charitable Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thank you for listening.